you. So Weaver's letter is really interesting, not only for its historical significance, but also because it's a really great read. In addition to being the first document to propose that the newly invented electronic computer could be used to translate human languages, it also suggested several mechanisms by which that computation could be carried out. And so what I want to do is start by reading a little bit from that letter. So Warren Weaver writes, "Think by analogy of individuals living in a series of tall closed towers, all erected over a common foundation. When they try to communicate with one another, they shout back and forth, each from his own closed tower. It is difficult to make the sound penetrate even the nearest tower, and communication proceeds very poorly indeed. But when an individual goes down his tower, he finds himself in a great open basement, common to all the towers. Here he establishes easy and useful communication with the persons who have also descended from their towers. Thus may it be true that the way to translate from Chinese to Arabic or from Russian to Portuguese is not to attempt the direct route, shouting from tower to tower. Perhaps the way is to descend from each language down to the common base of human communication, the real but as yet undiscovered universal language, and then reemerge by whatever particular route is convenient." And so this is a really great metaphor. It is so great that it dominated the field of machine translation for more than 40 years. During that 40 years, machine translation was essentially the avenue by which the field of computational linguistics was also born. And so it's often embodied in this well-known diagram called the Vauquois triangle, which says that the way that we want to do machine translation, so we've inverted Weaver's towers here, they're just upside down, so the towers are at the bottom, and they're just the surface tokens of the words, and we take the surface tokens of an input string, convert it to its syntax and its semantics. Hopefully the semantics of your source language are quite close to the semantics of your target language, and then you go all the way back down on the other side. And so, as I said, this was the dominant view of machine translation for more than 40 years, until in the late 1980s, a group of researchers led by Fred Delinick, in whose memory we are all here today, took another passage from Weaver and reinterpreted it. And so this one says, "One naturally wonders if the problem of translation could conceivably be treated as a problem in cryptography. When I look at an article in Russian, I say this is really written in English, but it has been coded in some strange symbols. I will now proceed to decode." And so Weaver was making direct reference to information theoretic methods developed by his colleague Claude Shannon. These were interpreted by the IBM group as probabilistic methods, and so they said, if I have examples of coded and uncoded messages, which I'll just consider to be, in this case, sentences from the proceedings of the Canadian Parliament in French that have been translated into English, then I'll just learn a probabilistic model that maps one to the other. And so on the Vauquois triangle, what they did looks like this. And when they first presented this work, it was greeted with great hostility from the community. But as we all know, that since hindsight is 2020, this is the view that won the day. And so Google Translate is based on this kind of methodology. And other commercial systems. And so this is a very, very effective method. But they really are just looking, all they had was French sentences paired with English, and so these guys were very pragmatic, and so they said, I'm going to learn a model, all I have is sentences, so I'm going to learn a model from sentences to sentences. Now, something interesting happened in the last 10 years. At the end of the 90s, we started to have available large quantities of syntactically annotated data. And so in the last 10 years, we have started to see machine translation systems, again, using the IBM approach of just training probabilistic models on the data that go through syntax. And so this has been a major focus of the statistical machine translation community for the last 10 years. And so also within the last 10 years, we've also seen a number of very forward-thinking efforts led primarily by Martha in the US and by Jan here in Prague on developing large quantities of semantically annotated data. And so the situation that we now find ourselves in is something that looks like this, where these different layers of annotation essentially correspond to some form of syntax and semantics. It might not be the broad, all-encompassing semantics that we heard about this morning, but it is a step in the right direction. And so at the beginning of the workshop, we came in with a large amount of data that is annotated in these forms. And so at the end of the workshop, I'm very happy to say that we are starting to see a large number of statistical systems moving through various parts of this data set. So in the second part of the presentation, you're going to see presentations from several students describing their AMR parsers, which take sentences in one language and convert them to an AMR in the same language. They go either from sentences or from a dependency representation of syntax. You'll hear about both the coding and learning aspects of that problem. In the third part of the presentation, which happens right after the coffee break, you'll hear about efforts to basically merge the techno-grammatical representation of Prague with the AMR representation of Martha's group, and thereby provide a unified semantic representation for a large quantitative data. You'll hear a little bit about efforts to go between AMRs of different languages. You'll see, finally, in the very last section, you'll see some enterprising students who have taken surface Chinese strings and mapped them into English AMRs, and they'll also talk a little bit about generating English strings from English AMRs. And so this is all very exciting, but I want to now go on to introduce the first part of the talk, I want to mention one last thing. The one last bit of Warren Weaver's letter, which I thought was worth mentioning, was he says, it is one of the chief purposes of this memorandum to emphasize that statistical semantic studies should be undertaken as a necessary preliminary step. So we're only 65 years late, but here we are, and the preliminary studies have actually been undertaken. So now I'm going to go out to part one, and so this is on graph languages for AMR, and this is represents the efforts of not only the people up here, but this has been, you know, soliciting feedback and advice from really everyone on the entire team, and so this is really a group effort. And I want to motivate this with some examples. Examples of the kinds of problems that you might want to solve if you build a machine translation system. So one obvious thing I might want to solve is if I'm given an English sentence in the wild, if I just go out and find one and I want to translate it, the very first thing I might want to do is convert that English input sentence in some kind of Twitterese into some kind of English sentence that our system might actually recognize. Or I might want to take a morphologically rich language like Finnish and convert it into representations of its constituent meanings. I might want to take a Japanese sentence and map it to a tree representation of its syntax. Or I might want to take that Japanese tree and map it into an English representation of English syntax. I might want to take a German sentence and map it to a graph-based representation of its meaning. Or I might want to take a graph-based representation of meaning and convert it into an English sentence. And so what all of these things have in common is that the inputs and outputs are not just categorical data or numbers. They are structured objects like strings, trees, and graphs. And the other thing that these problems have in common is that they must cope with some form of ambiguity. And so the good news is that we have solutions for these kinds of problems. Representations of structured objects come to us from automata and transducer theory, and dealing with ambiguity comes to us from theories of probability. And so if I have an automata theoretic representation of a large set of objects, I can endow with probability to obtain distributions over large sets of objects. So distributions over strings, conditional distributions of trees given strings, conditional distributions of strings given graphs, and all of these things. So, our starting point in automata theory are automata over strings, trees, and graphs. And as I said, these are the objects, the fundamental objects that we care about. And we have several important things that we care about in automata land. We want an acceptor, which is a kind of device that recognizes whether a string is a language, a transducer, which computes relations between different types of structured objects. meet certain algebraic properties, essentially called context freeness, then you can make them probabilistic. We would also like to have efficient algorithms for recognition, intersection, and summation. And if you have all of this math written down, then you can actually implement it in a toolkit. And so this has been done for finite state string automata in the OpenFST toolkit, which is produced by Google and is widely used in speech recognition and machine translation. There is a corresponding toolkit, which is a bit newer for trees. This is produced at ISI, and the theory on trees is a bit newer. And so we were very curious about automata theoretic representations of graph. This is something that few of us knew a whole lot about coming into the workshop. And I should mention one other property of the graphs that we care about, since we're dealing with AMR graphs. We make a distinction between what we call local and non-local reentrancies. So a reentrant node is simply one which has multiple parents. And these reentrancies are caused either syntactic or lexical properties of the sentence. So in the syntactic case, we basically have a control verb like wants, which passes its subject to the embedded clause, believe. And so you can imagine there's some pronoun for the word boy here. But in the lexical case, we simply have to resolve the fact that the words boy and him refer to the same entity. And so we're calling this a non-local reentrancy, and it can basically happen anywhere in the string. The local examples can always be determined from the syntax if you have the syntax. So our starting point, we had a few different graph formulations that we cared about, and we also had a bunch of properties that we cared about. And the key thing I want to point out here is the nodes and the columns. For every, so we considered regular tree grammars, which only generate trees, directed acyclic graph automata, which generate DAGs, and HRGs, which can generate arbitrary graphs. And the key bit is that all of them was missing one of these nice properties that we care about. And so in the course of the last 4 weeks, we have started to sketch out the details of a new formalism, which we think might be promising for this, and so I'm going to turn it over to David to describe exactly what this is.
So during the course of this month, the Glamour team has been very, very busy and actually exploring a lot of different formalisms. And in this part, I'm just going to be talking about one of them. We talked about also adaptive star grammars and HR equational systems and visibly pushed down graph grammars and all kinds of other things. And this option that I'm talking about, which we're calling regular graph grammars, the tactic that we were taking here was not really to develop a foundation that we would right away be able to encode like a full-fledged theory of semantics in, but we tried to go as simple as we could and see if we could get these two pain points into the formalism. So HRGs can't do non-local reentrancies. You can't just take any two things and make them stick together. And DAG acceptors, they're not probabilistic, and we really need probabilistic. And so we really focused on these two points, and we said, can we make some formalism, no matter how simple, and can it be both probabilistic, and does it have a property that we can take any two things and merge them together? And so the formalism that I'm describing is super simple, but we think it does have those two properties, and as we continue to work it out, we think that we'll be able to get yeses in all of these in the entire column, but that'll still be future work. So regular graph grammars. It's just kind of a provisional name for now. Maybe we'll think of a better name later. Wow, this screen is really high. Our starting point, in retrospect, our starting point was DAG acceptors. These were introduced by Kamimura and Slutsky in 1980-something. And they only generated planar DAGs, and we know that our semantics are not just planar graphs. We have crossing edges. So Daniel Quirnheim and Kevin Knight had removed that planarity requirement and explored this formalism somewhat, but they recognized that it had some limitations. And so we're taking that as our starting point. If you're familiar with our formalism, it's very, very similar. If you're familiar with regular tree grammars, which are just like context-free grammars with states, then this should look really, really familiar. So up here we have an example of a regular graph grammar. So each rule has a left-hand side and a right-hand side. Is there a laser pointer? Oh, thank you. So each rule has a left-hand side, so T is a state, the left-hand side, and it has a right-hand side, which is a fragment of a graph. And in all the rules, they actually look just like fragments of trees. So again, if you've seen context-free grammars or RTGs, this should look super familiar, except that we're evidently generating bits of semantics instead of syntax. So the way it works like this. We start with a start symbol T. And this is the same grammar I just showed you on the left. We start with the start symbol T, and we want to generate the semantics for the sentence, the boy wants the girl to believe him. This was a graph that Adam showed you a couple of slides ago. So we just take the current state, or the current sentential form, we choose a state, and we apply a rewrite rule to it. So T gets rewritten to want, using the first rule. And notice that we remember what state we were in as a matter of bookkeeping. And then we're going to target this E and rewrite that with boy. We're going to rewrite T with a note like that. We're going to rewrite that E. And then for this E, we're going to do something different. We're actually not going to rewrite this E, but there's another rule that says if I have two nodes that are in the same state, I can merge them, no matter how far apart they are. So this E is going to merge with that one up there. All right, and we end up with the semantics that looks like that. And this is the semantics for the boy wants the girl to believe him. Yes. Oh, please. No problem. No, it's actually very good to pause here. Yeah. Late? Okay. All right, I'll do my best. All right, does everybody understand this formalism? How many people understand this formalism? I like Percy's trick. How many people understand this formalism? Including the people that just walked in. All right, I think that's good enough. All right, so that's regular graph grammar. That's how it works. So one of the main things that we spent time trying to figure out was how do we define a probability model for these things? And the problematic part's not the rewrite rules. The rewrite rules are really easy. The hard part is this rule that says I can take two nodes anywhere and merge them. How do I define a probability model over that actually defines a proper probability distribution where I assign a probability to each rewriting step, and the sum of all the possible rewriting processes should sum to one. And this turned out to be really challenging. So this is the model we came up with, and it's really, really simple because we had to make it simple in order to make it all work out. So, and actually I'm going to give you two versions of this, and you can decide which version you like better. So in the first version, these are just three states that I generated during the course of my derivation, and I didn't bother showing the graph because it's not important. So these are three guys that could be potentially merged. They're all the same state. Maybe they're going to be merged, or maybe not. And I'm going to imagine that I have a set of possible reference. And I don't want to philosophize at all about what these reference are. They're just nodes on the slide, and there's five of them. We have to choose some finite number of them. I'm guessing that it'll be rather large, but on this slide, there's only room for five of them. And then each state is going to randomly choose a referent, let's say with uniform probability. It doesn't have to be, but let's just say it is. It's simple. So the first guy chooses number 4, second guy also chooses number 4, third guy also chooses number 2, each one with probability 1 over n, where n is equal to 5. Okay, so it's really easy to see that this sums to 1, right? Because each one just makes its own independent choice. And then we say, if two states chose the same referent, then they're merged. If they chose different referents, then they're not merged. So this will define a proper probability distribution over the class of all possible mergings or not mergings. Does that make sense? Okay. The question is whether or not we'll be able to really model the actual linguistic phenomenon of coreference this way with something so simple. And so we can go one step further and, what in particular don't we like about this? There's a couple of things. The main thing I don't like about this is there's no easy way to control to say some states like to merge more than others. Like noun phrases, states that correspond to noun phrases should be more willing to merge than states that correspond to events. I think, because noun coreference is more common than event coreference. And you could adjust the number of reference, that would change the amount of merging that happens, but it's kind of a crude knob. So the second model that I want to show you does have a knob like this, and so we like this model a lot, but it has its own catch. This is the Chinese restaurant process. I think a lot of you are probably familiar with it. This is actually the Bayesian version of what I just showed you. If you just turn it Bayesian, and then you have an infinite number of reference instead of just five, you will get exactly the Chinese restaurant process. So here's how it works. Again, we have four states this time, and we need to decide whether or not to merge them. And instead of reference, we have tables. There's a metaphor of a Chinese restaurant that you may or may not be familiar with. And the first state always chooses a new table because he has to. There's no other choice. So that's done with probability alpha over alpha, where alpha is a hyperparameter that I can adjust per state. Then the second state walks into the restaurant, and with a certain probability, he will sit down at the table that the first guy sat at, or he will start a new table. Okay, and he sits down at the old table with probability 1 over alpha plus 1. It's 1 because there was one guy sitting at the table already. Now the third state walks in and starts a new table with probability proportional to alpha. And then the fourth state walks into the restaurant and sits down at the first table with probability 2 over alpha plus 3. So you see that the probability of sitting at an existing table is proportional to the number of people sitting at that table already. So the more popular a table gets, the more popular it will become. It does not correspond to any kind of reality about Chinese restaurants, but this is what the process is called. So if alpha is cranked all the way up to infinity, then that means every customer sits at their own table. That means this is a state that never merges. If alpha is cranked all the way down to zero, then I think it's the limit as alpha approaches zero, then everyone will sit at the same table. So this is a nice knob that we can use to control how much merging happens and how much doesn't. So that's great. We thought this was a fairly satisfying probability model. It sums to one. It's well-defined. It has a major disadvantage, and that is the probability of one state's merging. It depends somehow on the global state of the restaurant. It depends on stuff that's going on elsewhere in the graph. And that's going to cause problems for our algorithms later, our dynamic programming algorithms. And the basic problem is the customers are not independent in the Chinese restaurant process. They do have this property called exchangeability, which is very important. That is, if they walk in different orders, you still get the same probability. Super, super important, but they're not independent. So we have these two models, and this first model I showed you has the nice property of independence, which enables a lot of really efficient, relatively efficient algorithms. The Chinese restaurant process has more properties that we like, but it's not independent. So right now we have to pick between the two, and it remains for future work to think about how to cope with the limitations of each of these. The positive is I've given you not one, but two probability models for this formalism that allows non-local re-entrancies. And to our knowledge, this is the first time we've been able to do this. Clear so far? All right, so what's next? Okay, so usually when you invent a new formalism, the first thing that people ask is, what algorithm are you going to use to parse it? What algorithm are we going to use to recognize it? So, in semantics land, the term parsing or recognition is a little bit ambiguous. So, the recognition problem is given an input graph, an input semantics, and one of these regular graph grammars, I need to decide, does that grammar belong to the language generated by this grammar? That's the recognition problem. And there's a very closely related problem, which is, if I have a weighted grammar, not necessarily a probabilistic one, what's the best derivation for that graph? Or what's the total weight of all the derivations of that graph? Okay, these are all reasonable questions to ask. And if you're familiar with the use of semi-rings in FSAs or parsing, then you know that these are actually all the same problem, but you just plug in different semi-rings. And algorithmically, they're all identical. So here's a very rough sketch of how the recognition algorithm works. Everybody here knows the Viterbi algorithm, right? For finite state automata and for RTGs, convex regrammers. I hope so. So the Viterbi algorithm works like this. It's a recursive algorithm. You go bottom up through a tree, and we can compute the value for an entire subtree as a function of only the state at the root of the subtree. It doesn't depend on anything on the inside. Okay, and we know there's a finite number of states, so that means that we can summarize the information about the entire subcomputation very efficiently. And then we just work our way up and recursively compute the values as we go up. Makes sense, right? This is the Viterbi algorithm. You should learn this in graduate school. That's great. The recognition algorithm for RGGs works the same, except that we don't have trees anymore. We have graphs. If you remember back to Dan's talk, he said we have this mechanism called tree decomposition or tree width that can take a graph and make it look like a tree or tree-like. And so we can do that with a graph like this. It's just that we might have to process a swath of nodes that's wider than one node. So we're still going to go, quote unquote, bottom up this graph, but we might have to keep track of two or three or four states. It depends on the property of the graph. It depends on the tree width of the graph. For this particular graph, we'd have to keep track of two states at a time. But, you know, finite times finite, it's still finite. It should be quite reasonable if the tree width of this graph is low. And I'm not going to go into any more details of this algorithm, but that's the basic flavor. It's just like the Viterbi algorithm, or inside algorithm, or forward algorithm, or whatever. It's just that we might have to keep track of multiple states because of the reentrancies. The time complexity of this algorithm, it's NP-hard. Almost all the algorithms I'm going to tell you about today are NP-hard or NP-complete. But many of the algorithms we're going to talk about are known as fixed parameter tractable. So if I have a bound on the tree width, so like this graph is 2, then it is linear time in the size of the graph if I restrict myself to graphs of bounded tree width. So actually the algorithm is quite efficient if we put an upper bound on the tree width. There's an exponential in there, but it's q to the tree width, not n to the tree width, where q is the number of states in the grammar. Okay, so that's pretty good news. So then the question is, what is the actual tree width of the graphs in that we actually plan to process? And we did a study of this also, and we were, we thought it was going to be low, but we didn't think it was going to be this low. Average tree width is 1.55 in the LDC release of AMRs. That means literally half of the AMRs in this corpus are trees. And then the other half, they have tree width 2, 3, or 4, and 4 was the maximum. And we deleted the slide that had the example of 4. It was a nice example. Okay, there's a little proviso here. When you're actually running this algorithm, if you remember DanceTalk really well, you have to add some extra edges between the parts of the objects that are dependent on each other. So if you do that, that means you have to connect together the sisters. That's going to boost up the tree width a lot, actually. There are some nodes that have 17 children in the AMR bank. That means the tree width is going to jump up to 17. But by some simple extensions of the formalism, which we haven't worked out yet, but we're quite sure we'll be able to do, we can introduce rules that will create an arbitrary number of sisters that are independent of each other. And that way we won't have to add those extra edges between those nodes for adjuncts or adjectives or whatever. And so in practice, I don't think that the tree width is going to go much higher than 1.55, maybe 2.55, something like that. This algorithm is actually implemented in Julia, thank you Naomi, and it's working well. Yeah, it's implemented. All right. So that's the recognition algorithm. All right. In Giorgio's talk, he talked about an alternative view of parsing as intersection. Giorgio's talk, right? Or was it Giorgio's talk and Adam's talk? I don't remember. So parsing is intersection. And so the story looks something like this. Instead of just one box that says recognition, we're given a graph. Then we're going to create a grammar that accepts one and only one graph, namely G. And then we're going to intersect those two grammars together, and the result will be a new grammar that accepts one and only one graph, namely G, but it generates all possible derivations for G under M. Did that make sense? And then I'm going to do something interesting with that intersected grammar. I'm going to test it for emptiness, or sum up the weight of all of its derivations, or find its best derivation, or whatever. And so we're doing exactly the same thing before, except it's more complicated. But there are now new variations that we can play on this game that allow us to do interesting things. So if I have a transducer that translates Chinese semantics into... interpretation is a composition. Oh, okay. So if I have a transducer that takes Chinese strings and turns them into English semantics, let's say, you're going to hear about that later on today, although not in this formalism, then I can take a Chinese string, create a finite state automaton that accepts only that string, compose the two, find the best derivation, and out should come the best English semantics for that Chinese string. Just by recombining the machinery that we hope to develop and plugging them together in different ways, we can get instant NLP applications. Or if I'm given Chinese semantics, I can create a grammar that accepts just that Chinese semantics, compose it with a Chinese to English AMR translator, compose them, find the best derivation, and out should come an English translation. I hope I got that right. So again, using these basic building blocks of composition or intersection, which are very closely related, and things like argmax or summation, we can do a lot of really interesting things. So if you're familiar with toolkits like OpenFST, you know that there's a lot of flexibility that you get from being able to plug things together like this. So we would like to get a... So first step is, for a single graph, can I make a grammar that generates just that one graph? And in most formalisms, this is really trivial. It turned out not to be trivial in this formalism. Why? If I want to generate this graph, I make this grammar, right? I just say Q, each node gets its own state. So Q0 generates Q1, Q2, Q3. Q2 generates Q2, Q2, Q21, Q22. Q3 generates Q22. That all seems fine, except I need to make sure that I don't generate two nodes in state Q22. I need to make sure that those two guys merge together. And there's nothing in the formalism that forces two nodes to merge together. So in the grammar, I need to introduce a new thing that's called unique Q22. So this is a constraint that's now part of the definition of the grammar that says there can only be one node in state Q22. Once I introduce that constraint, then I can generate this single graph. Now I want to take two grammars and intersect them together to form a new grammar that accepts the intersection of the two original languages. So if you're familiar with how to do this for FSAs or regular tree grammars, not context-free grammars, regular tree grammars, then it's really, really familiar. You just take the state sets from the two automata, take their cross product. So like one automaton has two states, one automaton has three states. You just take their cross product, and the new automaton has the cross product of states. And then you just form all the possible combinations. The rules is exactly the same as intersection of FSAs. Then what do we do with these uniqueness constraints? If I had unique Q2 in one of the automata, and I'm now multiplying it by states R1, R2, R3, then I'll get a new constraint that looks like this, unique Q2, R1, Q2, R2, Q2, R3. And the meaning of this is only one node can exist in any of those three states. In other words, these three states cannot live together in the same derivation. You can only have one of these states. So we need to extend the formalism to allow this. Then we have intersection closure. All right. I'll go very quickly through this. So now the result is a new grammar that accepts the intersection. If that intersection generates a finite language, we can represent it as a hypergraph. So if you're familiar with in FSA land, you can represent like the possible hypotheses for a speech signal as a lattice. In parsing land, you can represent the possible parses of a sentence as a hypergraph. And the same is true here. You can represent all the possible semantics for a sentence or all the possible, you know, whatever, again, as a hypergraph. And so one of the things that you typically want to be able to do on a hypergraph is find the sum of the weights of all of the graphs contained in the hypergraph. And this is what I'm currently working on. We have an algorithm to do this. It's extremely similar to the recognition algorithm. But the only catch is the time complexity is again like this. It's fixed parameter tractable, so n is the size of the forest. And the constant is q to the tree width plus 1. But here, the tree width, unfortunately, is the tree width of that thing there. And this thing could have really, really high tree width. And we've come up with various optimizations that, in special cases, will reduce back to the recognition case. But we don't have any bound that can guarantee that this tree width won't be humongous. So we have an algorithm, but it's not as efficient as we would like yet. One of the really tantalizing things about this algorithm is, as a byproduct, it gives you a recipe for converting the hypergraph into a hyper-edge replacement grammar, which is another formalism that we've talked about. So this is an interesting link between the two worlds of RGGs and HRGs. But we have not fleshed out what the significance of that is, if any, but it's just kind of an interesting side note. All right, so here's the table that Adam showed you at the beginning, but the new column. So I've been rather optimistic in filling out this table. I put a yes into every single element of this column. But critically, so HRGs were not able to do non-local reentrancies. Of course, RTGs can't do any reentrancies at all. RGGs clearly can do non-local reentrancies. And DAG acceptors could do non-local reentrancies, but they did not have a probabilistic version. And I've given you not one, but two probabilistic models. And the star means, well, there's a little bit of a kink there. But we've given you not one, but two probabilistic models. The parts that we still need to work on are the question marks. So local reentrancies, I think it should be no problem. But like I said, we didn't spend a lot of time trying to work out like a linguistic theory that's encoded in this formalism. So it'll take a little more doing to handle local reentrancies. But it just shouldn't be a problem because local reentrancies just aren't that hard. The transducer version, we always meant to start working on it, and there were too many other things to work on. And so that's probably priority number one for this thread of research on RGGs. DAG acceptors do have a transducer version, and so there's every reason to think that there'll be an analogous version for RGGs. The question again is, will it be able to do linguistically all the things that we want it to do? So there you have it. And the recognition algorithm is fixed parameter tractable. For DAG acceptors, it was 2 to the n. Not so good. For HRGs, it's also fixed parameter tractable, but you see it's n to the k, where k is the tree width, and there's this nasty 3 to the d power, where d is the branching factor of the graph. So RGG recognition is a lot more efficient. It's fixed. It's for a fixed tree width, it is linear time. So that's all really good news. And I think that's it.
Okay, I'm going to talk about some what we think are fairly easy follow-up projects, things we haven't completely worked out, but that we think we could do in the next few months following the workshop. So the first one is getting rid of that 3 to the d factor that David was just talking about for hyperedge replacement grammar. So if you want to stay in hyperedge replacement grammar, can do some things that the RGG formalism can't. And we think that this might be possible for AMRs because, so D is the degree of the graph. So you're in trouble if you have a vertex with lots of edges. HMRs do have vertices with lots of edges, and they fall into kind of two categories. So the first is entities that are used in a lot of predicates. So an AMR kind of looks like, typically, you have a bunch of predicates at the top, and they all point to some entities that are reused. So you have nodes of high degree at the bottom. And there may be implicit arguments or regular arguments of some predicates in the AMR. And there are conditions where in the HRG literature, you can get polynomial time parsability even with high degree if your grammar meets some conditions. And one of them is that if you remove a fixed number of nodes, you don't break the graph into too many different components that aren't connected to each other. And that's the case for these entities at the bottom. So you remove some entity at the bottom, you still have all the predicates hooked up together. The other case where we have nodes of very high degree is conjunctions. So you can have like a list of 18 cities or people or something. And that's a little bit different. It's not necessarily at the bottom of the graph. But there's another condition, theoretical condition, that it's okay if you have a grammar that generates nodes of high degree, but each arc, if you remove the node of high degree, the pieces that you get can be derived independently. And so that makes sense for these long lists. You could imagine the grammar generating each item in the list separately and then combining them all together at the end. And I'll stop there.
So I'm Jeff Flanagan, and I'm going to give a quick introduction to parsing into AMR. So to build AMR parsers, we have training data like this. So we have sentences annotated with AMR data, so AMR representation. But one thing that's missing from this representation, what's missing from the annotation, is the alignments between the concepts in the AMR with the words in the sentence. So we don't know which words produced which concepts. So ideally, we would like to have this annotation. So we'd like to know that tour produced, you know, thing, domain, tour, and various things like that. So this is a requirement for building most parsers. So to build a parser, we built a rule-based concept aligner. And so what it does is it goes through the annotated data. And for each graph in each node, it tries to find each concept tries to find the words that it came from. And so it's a rule-based liner. It uses WordNet, surface similarity, and edit distance to do this. So once we have these alignments, then we were able to train a parser. And so this parser that I'm talking about is Jammer. It's this parser we presented at ACL this year. So what it does, it takes the input sentence. It identifies the concepts and the concept fragments participating in the sentence. And then once it has the concept for, oh gosh. Okay. Once it has the concept fragments, we connect the concepts together to form a connected graph, which is the meaning, which is the meaning representation for this sentence. So this is one way to do it. But in this workshop, we've explored other ways, or people have explored other ways of doing parsing. So we have Jammer, which is the one I just presented. It does string to AMR. It's grammarless and edge factored. So all the features that it has looks at only pairs of concepts. And then there's other approaches. So this synchronous hyper edge replacement grammar approach by Peng. So they're looking into that, and that is a generative model with a grammar using the synchronous hyper-edge replacement grammars. So it's a synchronous version of the grammars that you just heard about, or some of the grammars, I guess, you heard about earlier. And then there's this dependency tree. So it's dependency tree directly to AMR, grammarless, but a transition-based approach. And so we know from dependency part, like regular syntactic dependency parsing, that different approaches have different pros and cons, and so we'd like to, you know, we'd like to explore all these different approaches. So the talks you're going to hear about, the parsing talks that you're going to hear about today, there's going to be a transition-based parser that's going to be proposed, and then alignment between dependency trees and AMRs. So this is because the transition-based approach uses it uses dependency trees. We'd like to have good alignments between dependency trees and AMRs, so that's motivates Chen's work. And then to build a hyper-edge replacement grammar parser, or a parser that uses hyper-edge replacement grammars, we'd like to learn hyper-edge replacement grammars. So that's the work of Peng. So I guess that's it.
So that's our work. So different approach. Yeah, this column is what we do. And here's the outline. I will go through the motivation and system pipeline and pre-processing, then the system, and I will have some preliminary results to show everybody. So, motivation. So why do we want to go from dependency tree to AMR graph? Because from this picture, we can see that there's a similarity between dependency tree and AMR graph. We can see this once structure is very similar into the AMR graph. And also, the difference is the some of the nodes in dependency tree should be deleted, and we should add in the coreferences, and also some of the pattern can be defined to transform some of the nodes into a name entity on the right-hand side. So yeah, we think the dependency tree would be a good start for the AMR, parsing AMR. So this is a general view of our pipeline. So first we will take the AMR graph and sentences we will generate a Go graph, and then we'll parse the sentences into a dependency tree, which serves our input. And also then combine the Go graph and the dependency tree, we will put into the model and training it. So this is the training process. And testing, we just take the dependency tree and put into the model so it produces the AMR graph. And first I will talk about pre-processing. So why don't we directly learn the learning target is not AMR graph, because the AMR graph does not have index, and also AMR graphs has some of the nodes cannot corresponding to the sentences. So we would like to transform our learning target into a gold graph, which is this. So then the left hand side is the AMR graph, and the right hand side is the gold graph we would like to learn. So it's just basic pre-processing. We just replace the nodes, concept nodes in AMR into a span in the sentence, and then collapse all the name entity nodes. Yeah, and then the main part of our system is parsing. So basically our system is doing parsing as transitions. So here's all the set of transition actions I would like to apply on the dependency tree to transform our tree into our AMR graph. So we can see it's very intuitive and empirically designed. So yeah, I will show an example about this. So here's the initial state of the system. I will initial a graph with the dependency tree and go through bottom up to and apply all sorts of all the actions I have mentioned and to transform into our AMR graph. So we can see here we delete the determiner and then after several similar actions, we're going to merge this node into a name entity big node, and after several actions, we add this reentrancy, so it forms a gold graph. And now we know how to transform, but then I will talk about how to learn this model. So if we assume the alignment is correct, so we can design an oracle to generate this gold sequence of actions to transform dependency tree into a gold graph. So and we next can train a perceptron learner so to approximate this oracle. Yeah, and during this workshop, I have got some results. I'm working on the AMR Little Prince data set, and I have segmented it into development set and training set. And also, the first experiment I have done is directly measure the similarity between dependency tree and AMR graph. I think it will be interesting to see whether it's a good starting point. So the result is the first line, it's our baseline. We can see that it's a reasonable start. So, and the second line is our system trained using very simple features like word form and PS tagging. So we can see there is a big gain between this. So it's kind of working, and future I will involve more labels and produce AMR graph. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so trying to design a dependency-based AMR parsing. So I would like to have given him more training samples. So the first day we want to have an aligner, right? But so Jeff is present his generous aligner, which is a stream-based and he's used rule-based. So I would like to improve his aligner to its aligned AMR concept to the dependency node, and also it's a statistical-based. I use EM algorithm to run that. So how this goes on? So we see this example. So we given an AMR AMR expression and also the sentence, and we use the generous aligner to see, oh, it's perfect, it's aligned the concept with the surface form. And we can also get the dependency structure on here. But if we look further to this subgraph here, then see the German aligned the traffic and drug perfectly. But since the AMR will drop some proposition from the expression, in here we want to recover the alignment to align the concept to also to the PP phrase on the dependency node. So we not only align the surface form, we also want to given this new alignment between the traffic and the width. So it will align the whole concept to a PP. Okay, so what kind of alignment we're gonna do in here? So
First of all, we want to have the concept aligned to the dependency surface form, okay, which is already done by the GMS aligner. Second, we want to have the concept which align to the head of the dependency node, which cover the wall range. Okay, and also we want to cover the reentrance of the concept, which does not deal in the GMS aligner, and also some of the additional matching, which like we want to align the possible concept with maybe the can or could on the lexical side, and also some negative we want to align to not without impossible in the dependency tree. Okay. Let's move further to two more examples. So as usual, we have the AMR, we have the dependency tree, we have the GMS aligner. We can see for these two subgraphs, the concept say the boy. Boy is the head of the whole concept, but the dependency tree, he said the constructor is the head of this sub-dependency tree, is a head. But these two subgraphs, they are totally aligned. They express the same meaning. So we would like to not only align the surface form, but we also want align the head between these two subgraphs. Okay. Another example, we're talking about the reentrance. So we have one group at the left-hand side, and the GMS will align it with the organization. But we have another group on the right of this sentence, right? It's a co-reference to the first group. So our alignment, we want to align not only the first one, but also the second group to the organization. Okay. So here's our approach. So it's quite simple. So the first thing we're going to do, we just input everything to GMS alignment. So give us pretty nice surface form. Surface alignment. And the second one, we want to expand the coverage of the dependency tree node. So if the dependency node does not cover the whole wall range of that concept, we want to move that dependency tree node to its parents. So it will guarantee that you will, you know, expand the coverage of that dependency tree. At the dependency tree node. So we just moving further and further, and okay, to find out, okay, so this is the lowest parents which cover this concept. Then we start. Okay, and then we have two things to need to deal with. The first one is the reentrance concept. The second one is some of the aligned concept. So what we gotta do, we want to run an EN algorithm to run everything. So the first thing we need to do is collect all of the candidates, because alignment is kind of the NP-hard problem, but if we limit on this, only do these two kind of alignment, we can just, you know, reduce the training size. So we list all of the alignment candidates, and then we run an EN algorithm, in which we use the lexical and also the relation label, and also the 17 rows as the feature, and we run the EM algorithm. So the EM is still under running. Okay. Thanks.
Okay, hello everybody. So today I will talk about some strategy to learn high batch replacement grammar rules from some AMR data. So our task is to learn high batch replacement grammar and synchronous high batch replacement grammar from AMR bank. So our input is the AMR graphs and the sentences, and our output is HRG and the synchronous HRG rules. So why do we need to learn these rules? For HRG, if we have a high batch replacement grammar, we can test the quality of AMR graphs. Also, if we have synchronous HRG grammar, we can just parse strings to MRs or MRs to strings. Synchronous HRG rules is different with high batch replacement grammar rules in that it has rules on both sides to generate the strings, to generate strings and the AMR graphs. So we can parse on the string side, then we can derive the graph side, or we can parse the graph side to derive the string side. So the first task is string to AMR parsing. Our input is the English sentence, and the output is the AMR graph. So for example, we have input the sentence, the boy wants the girl to believe him. The output is the AMR graph that carries the semantic meaning of this sentence. So after Chan and Jeff presented their methods, I'll make a brief comparison. So as for input, Chuang's method is dependence tree, and our method and jammer is string, and output is MR. Only synchronous SGU methods use a grammar, and our model is generative. And as for training, we use MCMC to sample the hyper-edge replacement grammar rules. As for inference, we do CYK parsing on the string side, and we can derive the MR graph on the graph side. So first, I will derive some intuition by beginning with MR graph parsing. So we are given some HRG rules. Our input is the English MR graph, and output is the series of rules applied to derive this graph. For example, we are given, on the left of this slide, we are given a set of HRG rules. So HRG rules have left-hand side of an edge that has a non-terminal label. The right-hand side is a graph fragment that has non-terminal edges and terminal edges. So we are given an input of AM graph that has descendants of the same thickness. And the output is a series of rules to derive this graph. So we have six use the grammar to parse this graph. Okay. So finally, HRG rewriting system is kind of context-free rewriting. So finally, we can derive a context-free derivation tree. And essentially, each hyper-edge replacement grammar corresponds to one fragment in this derivation tree. We can see that the first rule corresponds to the first two layers of this tree. And we will rewrite each non-terminal with some graph fragments of the original graph. So as a previous graph has some kind of right-hand side that has three non-terminals, we want to binarize it that makes the right-hand side has only two non-terminals. So each hyper-edge replacement grammar rule corresponds to one fragment in this fragment decomposition forest. So our intuition for HRG learning is quite straightforward. So we want to build a fragment decomposition forest that has carried all possible derivations for the MR graph. So then we learn a derivation from this forest. That is, we sample a tree from this forest, and then we sample fragments from the tree. But there is problem with this strategy because MR graph is different with strings. Graphs has exponential numbers of fragments, and there are previous methods using phrase to extract synchronous hierarchy rules that you has some kind of substrings that it has only n to two numbers of phrases, but there are possible, but the number of fragments is exponential in that there are the split point for the graphs can be everywhere. So our strategy is to compare the fragments with the substrings, and we just add constraint for the fragments that can only be constrained to some substrings in the string size. So this is a very big assumption because we assume that the fragments can only be aligned to a continuous string, substring of the string side. So our strategy, so first we will need to construct fragment decomposition forest. We start from the sentence, we use Jeff's aligner to identify some fragments of the graph. Then we insert some unaligned fragments of the original graph into it. Then we build the fragment forest bottom up. So we just keep composing larger fragments from smaller components. and we do this bottom-up, finally we reach the whole graph. That from this way, we have derived the forest for all possible derivations. Then, as for HRG extraction, we just sample tree fragments from this derivation forest. This is quite similar to THG learning of Chang and Gilday's method. And we use Gibbs sampling. We sample top-down. We sample edges that can denote a tree of the forest. And we also sample the cut to sample three points in the tree to denote which fragment correspond to which rule. And so this is a forest. We have sampled these edges. We have sampled the tree, derivation tree. And after that, we sample some split points. So we have, so all the nodes with one is some kind of where we cut the fragments from. So finally, we derive the rules. So from this graph, we can see that we have derived six rules for this MR graph. And these six rules can be used to derive the, to parse the MR graph. So as for synchronous HRG learning, we just keep the strings because we can, when we build the forest, we just keep the fragment side, but now we can keep the string side in the chart, in each node, then we can learn some synchronous HRG rules similarly. We use the same sampling schedule. And as for the results, we have to finish the forest construction for 3,700 English MRs from MR Bank, and almost all of them have a binarized fragment derivation. That is, we can derive a forest and then we can start sampling. And as for sampling strategy, we use MCMC sampling, that is Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithm. And we can use like Gibbs sampling, or we can use some kind of block sampling to sample one the whole tree at a time, or we can just do sampling from top down. Okay, yes, thank you.
All right. As Martha just said, we're really interested in this top mapping from AMRs to AMRs. We don't know if anyone wants to do that mapping yet, but it would be interesting to at least explore it and to start looking into that kind of data. And we have small data sets, but there are two fundamental problems with mapping from semantics to semantics. One of them is that our current metrics for comparing graphs, for comparing AMRs, only work when your language is the same between the two AMRs. So the first question we had to deal with is how do you compare AMRs and say that two AMRs from different languages are really expressing the same semantics? And so Naomi Sapra will explain sort of a method she developed to do that. And then the other problem is that we just don't have a big parallel AMR corpus. And so we'll talk about leveraging up Czech technogrammatical annotations to AMRs, because we have those for Czech and English, to try to get a preliminary parallel corpora. So Naomi?
Okay, I give up. Okay. So I developed a system for aligning nodes across AMRs. It's based on SMATCH, which is the system that we have for monolingual inter-annotator agreement evaluation of AMRs. So SMATCH works by aligning nodes to other nodes based on trying to maximize the matching labels on nodes that have been aligned together, and also matching labels on edges between nodes. And so, for instance, you see here two AMRs by two annotators, and the green lines are showing you how the nodes would connect, and this is what it looks like when you've run SMATCH and visualized it with like that. So now the a single label to label alignment when the two graphs are in the same language is pretty simple. You just say, does half match as a string half? And if so, then that counts as a label matching point on two nodes. But with bilingual AMRs, you can no longer obviously just do a string match across the AMRs, and instead the system that I developed, Amrica, matches according to a likelihood score of a node aligning to a word, aligning to a word in the parallel sentence, and aligning to a node in the parallel AMR. And so in this case, you would sum over these two paths that you can see between those AMRs. The node word alignments, generally in English, we get them from Jammer's aligner, although there's been recent work apparently at ISI. And then just Giza++ alignment, any kind of automated alignment. We use NBEST lists so that we can give a likelihood score that's informed by multiple possible alignments. And then on the Chinese side, it's actually just a string match. Nodes that just represent abstract concepts that match string-wise are also aligned, and so that AMR pair ends up looking like this.
All right, and so the next question is getting AMRs for us to align. And so, as Adam mentioned, there are sort of two veins of like deep semantic annotation that have gone on. The recent one is AMR, but here in Prague, there's been pretty semantic annotation that's been going on for a long time, this technogrammatical annotation. And they have a relatively large parallel corpus of the Wall Street Journal and Czech translations of the Wall Street Journal. And so if we could convert T-layer, the tectogrammatical layer, which we'll refer to as T-layer, into AMRs, we'd have a nice large static corpus that sort of behaves like AMR behaves that we could examine. And theoretically, you could just take a T-layer parser and have sort of an AMR parser. So it would be valuable in two different ways. The reason we think we might be able to do this is that you're not adding information like you'd need to do with a parse. They're very, very similar in how much information they maintain. So they both abstract away from syntax. They throw away prepositions and things like that and just represent semantic roles, who's doing what to whom. They both represent things in essentially a graph format. They both do sentence-level coreference. But there's minor structural differences between the two. And AMR makes some more inference than the T layer does. So for an example of this, if you take the sentence, Peter is eager to please, on the left is the T layer annotation of that. On the right is AMR. You can see they're both using semantic roles. They both represent that the person wanting to please would be Peter. So the first thing AMR difference is that T layer has this coreference. Pronouns and things are separate nodes that are just marked as being the same as Peter. So to convert it to AMR, you'd have to turn that, get rid of that coreference, and link it back to Peter. AMR abstracts away from semantically light things more than T layer does. So be eager, you could say that's one concept of eagerness. And so we can delete the B on the left. You want to convert all these semantic roles that in T-layer are done in sort of a fine-grained general category into lexically grounded ones that AMR does. So ARG0 and ARG1 are very similar to actor and patient. They're just defined in your definitions of what pleasing is, what eager is, etc. So you need a conversion to that, and you need to lexical or sense tags for that. And then AMR does named entity annotation. So we need to convert that. So those are sort of the steps you need to get to an AMR from the T layer. Conversion procedures, we just converted the raw T trees into the general AMR format to graphs instead of relatively complex layers of graphs. Just tried adding named entity like classifiers using NER software, and then tried two different ways of converting automatically to the AMRs from the T-trees. And then at the end did some list-based stuff using lexicons for these things like semantic rules. So Andre will go through our first method of converting all these structural issues.
Okay, so the first method we used to kind of convert the graphs to handle some more complex issues like copula, attributes or non-core semantic roles is via PMLTQ rules, because for T-trees there's a query language called PMLTQ where you can set some conditions on the shape of the tree. So here you have a subtree and also on the various attributes that the nodes on the T-layer have, for example the lemma or the semantic role, or you can also use wildcards and this kind of stuff. And also you can set conditions on surface tokens that are aligned to those nodes, which is also present in the annotation. So we use this kind of query as a left-hand side of a rule and an AMR subtree as the right-hand side of a rule. And the rules are based on the AMR guidelines, but are more general, so they can be applied to different sentences. So here you have an example, the boy is responsible for the work, and here we delete the copula. So this node actually doesn't appear on the right-hand side. You can see the B node is not there. So, and this rule can be applied to a completely different sentence. For example, Andre was nervous about the presentation. So here you see that the tree shape matches, and I can assure you that the attributes match as well. And this converts to this subtree, which when we add the named entities, corresponds to a valid AMR. Okay, so now Tim will talk about the different method we used.
Okay, yes. Yeah. All right, and so we had a few issues with this particular thing because all the rules were applied at once, and yeah. So sometimes they would...
There are many clashes.
There were many clashes, and so we changed to a relatively simplistic idea of converting these AMR, sort of pseudo-AMR T-trees into essentially trees, actually constituency trees, and just using just a tree transformation tool to do that, and that way we have a sequential application of a bunch of just transformations to a graph. And the kind of changes that you need to make in this, like the example before, you need to find linguistic patterns that consistently can change. And at this abstract level, there's a relatively small set of linguistic patterns you need to change. And so coordination, T-layer defines semantic roles under a coordination as linking directly to the things. So for eating apples and bananas, the semantic role between and banana is that of a patient, because it sort of is presumed to pass up the tree. AMR treats it entirely differently, but it's essentially a notational difference. So you write rules to find these and to convert the labels or otherwise move them around. We have big lexical lists for light verbs, complex predications, and pump them into rules for how to change things. So AMR converts light verbs into single word, so give a blessing converts to bless. You just have rules go into lexical lists and change things accordingly. And then we have a bunch of just pre-existing resources. Some of them are just other annotations over the Wall Street Journal. Others are lexical lists or specific lexicon lists for the technical grammatical things, and so we just apply all of those. And this work, it does decently well, but we're just starting. So we think we'll eventually get decent conversions. Basically, if you just convert raw technogrammatical semantic roles to AMR roles, you start getting vaguely close trees. The T-surgeon with a bunch of fiddling gets better than automatic AMR parsing, but we think we'll be able to convert a lot better than that. And the promise with all of this is that we've currently done this for English, but the exact same strategy can be done for Czech, so that we can maybe have like a Czech AMR corpus as well that will be in parallel with the English. And that's it.
Okay, good afternoon. So we've talked a lot about transformations within Tecto to AMR and across AMRs. At some point during the workshop, we said we should actually try and getting an MT pipeline working. And so at some point we said we should actually try and get a complete MT pipeline working. So what I'm going to talk about. In the big ecosystem of all the representations that we have, I'm going to talk about going from surface tokens to AMR using Jammer, or essentially any other parsing of our choice, to surface tokens in English. You'll notice that this side, the surface tokens, are actually of a foreign source language. So the idea is that all that the parser needs for training is a sentence and a graph and some kind of alignment between the two. So Jeff already touched upon this. And the thing that makes this not cross-lingual is essentially one really tiny piece. And that piece is that Jammer, for example, uses rules to do this alignment. And the rules are based on edit distance and WordNet and so on. So if that sentence was Chinese, this won't work. So if we just fix that little piece, we can actually get an MT pipeline to work. And for essentially very little work, and most of the heavy lifting is done by the parsing and the generation. So we thought we should do that. So what we did was we took a large parallel corpus, so source and target, and then we ran Jammer on the target side. So in this context, the source is Chinese sentences and the target is English. So the target AMR is now English. So we've already trained Jammer to do English parsing. So we just do AMR parsing for all the target side. So then you end up with something like this. And now we have two target and source sentence pairs, and we just ran word alignment between the two. And then we said, okay, now that we have those alignments, let's just project that to the AMR, and which is really straightforward. And then you'll end up with essentially a training corpus for a parser like Jammer to learn how to parse from any source language to the target AMR. So that's kind of cool. And then and it works. Well, I'll get to how it works. Another thing we tried was to, instead of going via an intermediate target sentence, why can't we just directly go to the target AMR? The intuition behind this is mainly noticing that sentences could have a lot of surface variability, but hopefully the AMR that's underlying them would be less variable. And so we thought we could just serialize the target AMR and then just make it a string. We kind of know what order it should be in because we've seen the target sentence, so we'll just have it in the same order and then do the same thing. Just do word alignment. Pretend that the concepts are words and do word alignment. And then we can project the source sentence over to target concepts just the same way. And then we have training data for parsing, and we've seen three talks on how we can do parsing. This was built for Jammer, but potentially it could work for any parser. And then we have a way to go cross-lingual. We'll also see generation in a second, so that part will also be done. So we'll have a full pipeline. Before I show you how it did, I'm just going to talk about the results, the data use. So we used FBIS, which is around 300,000 Chinese English sentences. For the concept table extraction, we used most of the data. For concept ID identification, we used 10K, and for relation identification, we used 100 sentences. This is mostly limited because we wanted to get the training over before, in a reasonable amount of time. So there's no reason why this couldn't be larger, and it probably should be larger. So how does it do? So I don't have official, like formal results, like number-wise, but I have some examples of how the generation went through. So this is what we should see for that sentence pair. Lastly, he wished Chairman Li Ping every success in his visit to other countries. So this is what we got when we actually gave the parser concepts from the English sentence, and we said, okay, at least use the Chinese data to do the relation. And it does okay-ish. So, for example, it thinks that chairman is some kind of a predicate. So someone chairmaned a visit. Although they chairmaned it successfully, which is good. And then it also knows that someone got wished, was wished for this successful visit, except it doesn't know that there's a he. There's this, he was doing the wishing, but it thinks that Li Peng did the wishing to somebody, to chairman a visit successfully to other countries. So it got all of that part well. It just, there were some relations it obviously failed on. So it would actually be curious just to see what sentences would come out of this. I think it would be kind of interesting. But we haven't, we'll probably get to that when Jeff talks about generation and when we have the generator ready. And if we don't give it the concepts from the English and we say everything is from the Chinese sentence, which is probably how a true translation system should work, it kind of drops some more concepts. But to be fair, we kind of looked at this Chinese sentence and it does have concepts like achieve. So instead of just saying, I wish you success, the sentence I think says, I wish you achieve success. So it kind of extracted some concepts that don't appear on the English side. So these are some issues that we're facing right now. Hopefully, more data and or better alignment should fix that. So that leads into future work where I say we probably need to have more data on all the stages of training. We haven't done any error analysis. This was just some graphs that we got kind of late last night. And for those of you who are familiar with word alignment, you would kind of find many holes in this word alignment concept slide. That's probably a good reason to worry, and we should probably do phrase alignment rather than just word alignment, because training on Jammer with English sentences and English AMR, it aligns entire phrases to subgraphs, and what we've done is just approximated that with word alignment. And it would be really cool to do more language pairs. Essentially, if we do this alignment, we can pretty much do any language pair that we have enough data for and enough AMRs to train on. So that is it. Thank you.
other questions or comments?
Thank you. As a visitor who's only here for the last 3 days, I'd like to say thank you for exposing me to the summary of all the fine work you did. And in the same spirit, I think, as the previous question, in the monolingual universe, my feeling is the non-trivial part of several of the problems that you discuss is the uncertainty about which pieces of the signal, substrates, relate to which pieces of the meaning of the nodes. And so I was going to ask, it's primarily the creators of sandbags, the AMR sandbags. How much harder would it be to actually annotate that relation? I suspect the annotators, as they decide on the meaning, actually have a fairly clear idea of which pieces of string correspond to which part.
Yeah, that was something that I think has become very clear to all of us as well, that this step of aligning the tokens to the AMR is a necessary requirement for everything that we're trying to do. And it sure would make everybody's life a whole lot easier if these AMRs just came already aligned. So the tree bank and the prop bank actually do very carefully preserve the alignment to the tokens. The tectogrammatical annotation very carefully preserves that alignment. So an observation that Jan just made, I think that was today, was another advantage of trying to automatically convert the tectogrammatical to AMR is that maybe we can preserve that alignment in that conversion process. So then we have AMRs for the Million Word Wall Street Journal for both English and Czech that would have the token the alignment between this, the tokens of the string and the parts of the nodes of the AMR, and that would be, we'd have gold standard alignment, and that would be really beneficial for anybody who wants to do, whether they're doing, parsing or, whatever they're trying to do with it. I think it would, yes, certainly the annotators are very aware of the chunks of the sentence that they're doing. From an annotation perspective, it wouldn't be that hard. You create the nodes in the tree as you're creating the tree, and then you could just highlight the span that corresponds to that node. And there's some of them are discontiguous spans, but that's, we've already, we know how to handle that with other types of annotation. It would take a little bit more time on the annotator's part, not much. It would obviously, the annotation tool would have to have a way of recording it all. The AMR editor that we use for doing the annotation is already just an absolutely wonderful editor that has a whole lot of stuff built into it that we've never tried to build into any other annotation tool I've ever seen that makes it a lot easier to do AMRs and to do them consistently. We'd have to persuade the person who's implemented this tool, who's already done all these really wonderful things, that this is yet another wonderful thing that would need to be done, which wouldn't actually help the annotators, but would help the people who want to build systems. That was kind of a long answer to that question, but we have not. It has come up. It's been mentioned a couple times as, why don't we do that? But there has not been a lot of enthusiasm on the part of the implementer to add this feature so far. Maybe we can persuade him.
That's a big follow-up. Maybe I could offer a candidate argument. You said it would not help the annotators. I'm not sure of that. So in some cases, the annotators actually do the correct interpretation. And he tried his requiring them to record which pieces of also make that decision more explicit. Yes, it would impose additional load or practical effort on the annotators, but I'm wondering if it might lead to a better annotation.
just my gut reaction is it would take a little bit more time on the annotator's part, but and it certainly would be worth doing from the perspective of the annotation. We don't get very many errors, very many disagreements for things like coreference as it is. So I don't know. Tim, do you have any instincts on whether or not you think it would help the annotation process?
In some ways it might help the annotation process. I think we understate how much it might add time cost to AMR because AMR, unlike a lot of other annotation things, is just done over the text instead of over some sort of complex syntactic structure you already have. I mean, I feel like T-layer is derived over A-layer, and so you already have, you know, collection. For AMR, you'd have to gather a whole span for what you're linking, or for every word, you'd have to mark the alignment for that word. And that could take a lot of time for a large sentence.
So you think that it would take more time?
I think it would take a lot more time, the way we currently do AMR.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you could imagine some of it being kind of a pre-processing step that would give you a bunch of tokens that you could then kind of assemble that would already sort of carry with them their alignments. But that would mean probably a whole nother
In some ways, correcting, I mean, Jeff has an alignment tool that lets you manually correct alignments. In a lot of ways, that seems like that would be easier as an annotator than linking things up for the AMR methodology.
Yeah, and we've also got a fair number of AMRs that are built on data that had already been tree banked and prop banked. So it shouldn't be that hard to kind of project those alignments, and then you'd still have to some gaps to fill in. But yeah. So it's should we stop?
Let's call this time to Martha for managing the local and the next presentation. We should allow people to take a short break, but otherwise we'll need to. Because how many minutes do we have?
Everybody's going to be 10 minutes.
Hello. This would be a good time to return your keys to the same time. Thank you.